Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for September's Exotics Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome back to Webinar Club our speaker for today, lecturer and clinical manager of the Exotic Animal and Wildlife Clinic at the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies, University of Edinburgh, Kevin Ewell. Thank you, Kevin. I'm now going to hand over.
Thank you very much, Aima. And today we're talking about analgesia of small mammal patients. And I think we need to be aware that most of the patients we're going to be seeing coming through in the clinical setting are prey species. These are able to hide disease incredibly well. And most of the, I suppose, circumstances that leads to them being presented is where we're seeing acute clinical signs, in many cases riding on the back of chronic disease processes. And obviously, we need to be looking at monitoring for signs of pain, or discomfort in these patients, and obviously getting analgesia on board preemptively is critically important. We of course do have to start with the basics when we're evaluating these patients for pain and discomfort. First step is of course is we need to know the weight of that patient. Very important for calculating our drugs, and it may be with the small mammals we can't really rely on species ranges per se, but obviously you may have records that you can compare the weight of that patient to previous. Next thing on our list then is thinking about where these are going to be housed and visual security as well. Having prey species in direct contact or exposure to predators may heighten their anxiety. This may lead to increased sort of perception of pain as well. For example, in here we have a ferret. This ferret couldn't care less where it is housed. It is currently sleeping. On this slide, and here on the left, we have a guinea pig who is sitting inside its empty beer box, where it's able to feed and skulk away if it needs to. And on the right-hand side in there, somewhere, there is a gerbil that's made a lovely nest, and again, it's out of sight, out of mind, really. It's sort of not able to be stressed by the environment as well. So we've got to think about how we're going to set up their hospitalisation to minimise anxiety in these species. And of course, sometimes having friends with you may be helpful and supportive, depending on the illness, depending on the nature of the problem, as to whether we want this patient to be mixing with friends or not. And of course, we're wanting them to be continuing to feed and eat and drink and do things normally when they're in as well. And so having some of their normal food, some treats and things to try and get these animals feeding. They either have a high metabolic rate or we're concerned about gut stasis. All these things we discuss at length, really. We'll have all these on board to maximise the chances of a successful outcome for that patient. And then we've got to start thinking about if we have painful areas, do we need to be immobilising these? And depending on the species that we're dealing with, being honest, some of the bandaging techniques we might be considering for other species might be quite limited. We have to factor in how heavy a bandage is going to be. This can then put traction onto painful tissues, which you know is going to act more like a pendulum more than actually stabilising a fracture site. May add significant weight and drag for the patient to be trying to move around too. And of course, you can't really explain to our patients why they are being bandaged, and you may have animals that then are reluctant to feed. You may have other animals that may be wishing to try and remove this bandage, and you know we can see circumstances where you can get self-inflicted trauma from chewing, grooming, trying to remove a dressing, making a fracture that was perhaps closed into an open fracture through trying to get a dressing off. So you do have to start stepping back and thinking about how do I go about stabilising wounds, for example, and is this going to be of benefit to that patient or is it going to make the situation worse? And of course, other things that we do need to be thinking about here is getting our baseline parameters for the species. So we need to have a feel of what weight it should be. We need to make sure this animal is able to maintain normal thermia. And obviously, heart rate and respiratory rate may be a factor here in terms of trying to identify if this animal is increasing anxiety or is showing some sort of pain response as well. So knowing what our normal physiological parameters should be is obviously a good starting point. And then we have to ask the next question is, can this animal sustain itself? And if we're looking at some of the more subtle signs of pain or discomfort in these species, then obviously if we've got chronic weight loss, then that may be an indication this patient is unable to sustain itself in terms of adequate hydration, adequate nutrition, and that may be associated with pain, may be associated with poor mobility, for example, unable to get to suitable water and feed resources if they're group housed, for example. And then the next thing we have to think about is owner and animal compliance. You may come up with the most beautiful analgesic regimen for this patient, but if you are going to be sitting there fighting with a slightly grumpy chinchilla every half an hour trying to get it to take medications whilst you're putting pressure on the animal, or maybe you're further manipulating sites of pain, then clearly this may not be helping the situation here. So you've got to come up with something that is practical that you can apply to that patient, which the patient will tolerate and that the owners will be capable of doing at home. Or alternatively, if the owners aren't going to be capable of doing at home, you have to come up with a regimen that fits in with the daily working life and the commitments your teams have without over stressing that patient too. And obviously, if you're dealing with rats that may be wanting to take their peanut butter, then you can lace this with a variety of different products that is necessary to get them to take the analgesia on board. So you've got to factor all of these in when you're coming into a plan for these patients. And I think we need to be very aware that even in the critically ill patient, we don't want to be overlooking pain. We need to be thinking about analgesia in all the patients that come through. And of course, by their nature, we're going to have very limited signs of pain, and that's partly because of trying to hide signs of weakness as prey species. So ideally we want close but discreet observation. The clinical history from the owner is very important in terms of how the animal's behaving. You know, we might have anorexia creeping in, we might have them being reluctant to move, depression, apathy, maybe we've got body condition loss as well, combined with a reduction in weight, all these things. And really, this is just a little sort of list of the possible sort of signs of pain that we may be seeing in some of these species. I put sort of anxiety, apprehension, and restlessness here. We could probably add on to here, put aggression into that order as well, with that, where you're getting an altered behavioral response into that patient, where you're seeing a heightened sort of response. On the other side of that as well, you may also get the alternative of that, where you're going to get apathy coming through, where you might have immobilization, you might have them acting dull, you might have them sitting in a corner and doing nothing either. You know, that's also a possibility. We then have maybe some postural changes creaking in here that you might start seeing. So you might be seeing a hunched posture, a facial grimace maybe. Maybe the respiratory rate is elevated beyond normal. Maybe some tooth grinding in some species as well, where we're seeing signs of discomfort coming through as well. And you might also, in a group housed animal, have them seeking to be isolated from the main group, or being picked on or even bullied. There's also one of the things you may be seeing. So there's a change in that social hierarchy as well. Vocalization may occur with acute pain, but would be quite unusual in a lot of these species. And then if you're looking at more a focal area of discomfort more than generalized discomfort, then we may be looking at scratching or licking, nibbling, self-traumatizing a wound area, for example. If it's oral pain, we might have salivation coming through as well, you know, a collection of things coming through. And so you've really got to think about the nature of the disease process and what pain you would anticipate and how that translates to the clinical signs that you're going to be seeing. And this, of course, can be quite difficult if you're presented with a rat in a box. You're thinking, OK, is this rat in pain? You've got to obviously take a while to evaluate that patient and see how it's behaving. And if you're concerned about any of your inpatients, then, like I say, sitting and spending time watching them is critically important. In terms of when to give analgesia, we know really we want to be using a variety of different drug classes to limit side effects of these agents, and obviously then try and get analgesia in place before or we're anticipating a painful stimulus. And certainly because of the lack of clinical signs, maybe our concerns about the health of the patient that we're dealing with or concerns of side effects, then this is often used and probably disproportionately used as a justification for not giving appropriate analgesia to exotic species, when in fact we should be stepping up our game and doing that. The one thing that you do have to bear in mind is obviously if you're anticipating this animal undergoing anaesthesia and having diagnostics or other things going on during this process, then you've got to think about, okay, how is my analgesic regime going to fit in with my subsequent anaesthetic, and I may be needing to modify the protocols I've gotten for anaesthesia or modify my analgesia prior to inducing anaesthesia in that patient, for example. So you've got to sort of factor in these two together. If we start looking at, I suppose, the range of options that we have available, and I think it's worthwhile stepping back and looking quite globally at the range of analgesics we've got here, because obviously they can, the usage can massively vary depending on the case you're dealing with. So I think we're all fairly happy that non-steroidals are pretty much in routine use, certainly in the current profession now. Obviously, we do have side effects with GI ulceration, bleeding, kidney damage, things like that. And these are real, to be honest with you, and they are relevant. So certainly when you're dealing with chronically sick patients or critically ill patients, then we do have to be aware that hydration is going to be very important. And maybe we should be looking at running blood urea creatinine or urine protein creatinine ratios to confirm that we've got adequate renal function before giving non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. And if we're concerned about GI ulceration or bleeding, particularly that suggests we're in ferrets, for example, with signs of GI disease, or rabbits with gastrointestinal disease, maybe then we are interested in looking at a packed cell volume or giving ulcer protectant drugs. And of course, ranitidine, as will be fairly standard in the therapy that we would be using for hindgut fermenters like the rabbits, guinea pigs, dagoes, chinchillas, but also fairly standard in the ferrets as well, where GI ulceration is an increased risk. And your non-steroids, of course, can be given both parenterally and via the oral route, depending on your circumstances. And I suppose our first line, really, out of maybe habit to some extent, but meloxicam is a fairly first-line choice for us. The oral solution is quite sweet-tasting, quite palatable, very good owner compliance for giving that to the patients. It's something you can continue long-term at home as well. So depending on the case, you may be going for parenteral therapy, perisurgically, for example, or in the acute situation. But on the more chronic patients, then oral meloxicam is a fairly reasonable mainstay for a lot of our patients. And I think, like I say, once you're happy that your side effects are limited and this is something that is tolerable for the patient, then this is something we would be continuing. And then we've got to think about opioids as next on our list. And I think this is quite important across the board to perhaps think about. More major procedures, trauma, surgery, then obviously great. I think we'd all be reaching for opioids for these species. Butorphanol, of course, is very commonly used in practice, largely because it's obviously in terms of controlled drug schedules, really. We do have to be aware that it's a mixed agonist-antagonist, and it's got a very short duration of action and very limited analgesia that it affords for our patients. So realistically, we're not using butorphanol for the small mammals at all. It's just not of adequate use, really, in terms of the circumstances where we feel we need it. Obviously, I've just got a general dosage chart here going through for you here, but it's giving you the sort of doses that we would be considering using for a variety of small mammal species here. And like I say, you know, if you're dealing where you're thinking you might have 1 or 2 hours of pain only where you need an opioid, then maybe butorphanol is your choice. But in many cases, the need for repetitive administration makes it quite difficult to administer. Next on the list, when we're looking at the opioids, is the partial agonists, and buprenorphine, of course, is another very commonly used product. And this really is our go-to product, really, for a lot of the cases that we're dealing with. It does take a while to have an effect, so if you're going to be giving this as part of an anaesthetic regimen, then you do need to get it in quite early. But of course, it does last for quite some time, so it's quite sensible, quite practical when you're looking at repeat dosing for more chronic pain or post-operative pain or perisurgical pain in these patients. And our typical regimens for buprenorphine is an 8 a.m., 4 p.m. and a midnight dosing for our inpatients that are with us. So for more chronic diseases where we're feeling we need some opioid involvement, then buprenorphine is easily the winner for a lot of those cases. Dosage range is very dependent on species, between 0.01 and 0.2 mg per kg. Then obviously there is a rate sort of limiting response here where giving higher doses no longer has any beneficial effect. Buprenorphine has a very high affinity for receptors as well, so it's a competitive agonist, but obviously does tend to bind quite strongly. Higher doses, we do have to be aware that we can get rebound hyperalgesia where we're getting potentially increased pain after the removal of buprenorphine. But again, that would only be at very high doses, and I don't think we would be using doses at that sort of level in a lot of our species where that should be of concern. Again, just the same chart here, showing you a buprenorphine sort of range of doses that are offered. We actually pitch in for our buprenorphine maybe at some of the slightly lower ends of the dosage ranges. Part of the reason for that, quite simply, is in terms of having some of the side effects coming through, but also it just means if somebody does inadvertently double dose a creature, you're still within that therapeutic range for them. And obviously, we've got lots of staff changing over with different shift patterns. If you've got a patient on this treatment longer term, then having a little bit of safety in there is not a bad idea. For buprenorphine, one of the sort of maybe other options out there is to consider giving it orally. Either of the buccal mucous membranes or in jelly has been advocated. And this actually, when you go back and look at the literature, you're looking at a tenfold increase in dose orally to get it into the patient. That said, the effectiveness of this is in doubt. There's been a number of papers showing that really this is not getting adequate levels to cause behavioural changes in animals undergoing pain studies, and it's not something we really do now on the ground, so we're not even sure that it actually is physically working. The other way, of course, you can consider then is to switch over to tramadol, and there's oral liquids, soluble tablets or capsules available for this. We sort of have a vague idea of a dose, 11 mg per kg once a day in the rabbits. But again, there's been studies showing that this is below sub-therapeutic levels or serum levels you'd expect in people to be effective causing analgesia. Now, okay, you know, the serum levels you're required in your rat, the serum levels you require in your mouse might be different to a human, but the argument is we're not even sure this is effective either. And in, again, some studies, and this is just looking at rats here, where they were giving an oral dose of 50 mg per kg, and there was no evidence clinically of an analgesic benefit. That said, I think most people now are often using a dose of 5 mg per kg twice a day orally. That's a standard dose that we'll be using for a lot of our small mammals as well. And if this is something you're going to do, we do have to be honest, I guess, that we don't have the evidence base that this is being therapeutic and working either. So when we're looking at using tramadol or the oral buprenorphine as an analgesia for longer-term management of patients, or even in the shorter term post-surgery, we do make sure we are absolutely critically happy that this patient is nicely stable, that we've been progressively reviewing analgesia such that we are happy to switch off of parenteral analgesia because we know that works at a suitable time point. So even where we are considering use of oral agents such as this, we're normally looking at, again, it depends on the nature of surgery, but it may be 24, 48, 72 hours, sometimes longer than 72 hours post-surgical procedures before we switch on to oral therapy, which does mean these are in patients for longer, but we need to be guaranteeing we're getting adequate analgesia. So moving on from the mixed agonist antagonist or the partial mu agonists or oral therapy, then obviously we've got to look at stepping up our game a little bit where we are doing more invasive procedures. And I think for me, anything more invasive than a routine of area hysterectomy, then we should be looking at pure mu opioids. And certainly even now, there is an increased trend towards using pure mu opioids for those procedures perisurgically, downgrading subsequently onto buprenorphine afterwards, and I don't think that's a bad way to be going forward either. Morphine is a drug that we've had for a very long time. We have standard dosage regimens. We know they work. Effect for time scale in a lot of the species we're dealing with around 2 to 3 hours, but standard sort of dosing regimens out there for morphine is sort of 2 to 5 mg per kg every 4. But obviously, you may have some evidence of pain breaking through depending on the species that you're dealing with. And once again, you've just got a morphine dose here as well for you here, where we're giving the range that you'll see in species, and obviously it depends on what you wish to do for them. But morphine, like I say, is a good drug. We know that it works. Fentanyl is also on your list here, and another pure mu opioid. Downside of fentanyl is that it's very, very short acting, and so we worry that this is going to give you a very, very short space of analgesia. Maybe 5 to 20 minutes is all you're going to get. So this works quite nice for continuous rate infusions, which we'll be talking about later, but obviously not really so practical in terms of intermittent or repetitive dosing of opioids. I think the great use for this is if you are having a patient under anesthesia and you are anticipating an area of heightened pain, so you're about to, let's suggest, you're going to start being pulling on ovarian pedicles for a spay, for example, then you could preemptively give a dose of fentanyl intravenously during that surgical procedure. And then obviously you can get some additional analgesia at that heightened point of pain, which is going to wear off quite quickly. I suppose as an alternative to having to increase your inhalant, which arguably is not giving any additional analgesia. I put pethidine here as well, just as an aside, but again, very short acting, 2 to 3 hours. About 10 mg per kg, another pure mu opioid, and again, obviously, is licensed and available. for veterinary use, but maybe again is one that maybe is a bit less on our list. Again, it's not one we're commonly using in our clinical setting. It is worth also adding into here fentanyl fluanazone, because this obviously is licensed as a combination. But again, your fentanyl is very short acting. It's the fluanazone in the hypnorm, which is the neuroleptic, which can lead to a very long sleep time in these species, a very protracted recovery. So much as you're going to immobilize your patient maybe, and that's good if you've got a post-operative fracture or something going on, the amount of analgesia they're going to be getting from this may be quite limited. And certainly where you're looking at repeat dosing and what do you do after giving hypnorm, if you're using this for more major procedures, you should be following with a pure mu opioid very quickly, or following with buprenorphine or something very quickly during the process. So riding that on top of the sedation you're going to get from your fluanazone, because your fentanyl is going to run out very, very quickly indeed. And actual doses of fentanyl used, when you're looking at the data sheet and dosing this, if you're giving between 0.2 and 0.5 mils per kilo, then obviously you're going to be getting quite a reasonable dose here. And I've given that dosage range on there for you between 0.063 and 0.157 mg per kg alongside your fluanazone. And hypnorm reversal is obviously quoted in many cases as using buprenorphine, butorphanol or naloxone to reverse the fentanyl component of this. But given fentanyl is so short-acting, then arguably you're removing what little analgesia you've got. You've still got the long sleep time from the fluanazone. And I think we just have to be cautious that if we're going to use partial agonists, mixed agonists or pure antagonists, that this is going to have an impact on your subsequent analgesia with that patient. And in some cases, if you do feel the need to using a pure mu with something that's going to sleep for a long time, then I'd argue this is primarily going to be a patient that needs more analgesia than afforded by fentanyl or these products alone. This then brings us on to methadone, obviously now licensed for veterinary use. And we quite like methadone, I guess. We prefer it on the grounds that there are maybe less side effects than some of the other pure mu opioids. Onset is rapid, which is great. And certainly if you compare it to morphine, depending on species and the papers that you're reading, but you can get better analgesia in the first 40 minutes relative to morphine. Lasts for 2 or 3 hours, and obviously the dosage range we're using is between 0.3 and 0.7. And again, we're dosing every 4 hours. It does have some additional actions as an NDA antagonist, and this can be more important maybe for chronic or neuropathic pain, and we'll come on to a little bit when we talk about ketamine later. It does increase the level of sedation compared to morphine, so you do have to be careful with the amount of repeat dosing of methadone, and certainly if we're getting up to the 0.7 mg per kg doses for some of the species like the rabbits, then you will see some profound sedation creeping in, which you won't get with the morphine. So you just need to be mindful of that when you are sorting out dosage plans for your patients. Patches are available for opioids, not really something we're using in a clinical setting much, really. The size of the patches, difficulty keeping them in place, needing to shave your patient to get access, obviously is a risk of hypothermia as well. They can take quite some time to take onset of action, up to 24 hours. But of course, you can get analgesia maintained for 72 hours after that. So maybe depending on your circumstances and your clinical setting, you may find more use for patches. But certainly in our setting, realistically, we're not really using patches much. We're quite happy with our parenteral dosing. We do have to think about side effects of the opioids. And obviously there's quite a collection of these. And some of these are obviously more immediate concerns for us. Obviously sedation is part of that. That may be a positive thing, but obviously heavy sedation may be a bad thing with a critical patient. We'll have some cardiovascular and respiratory depression. And obviously you may then get some gastrointestinal signs as well, which I guess we're going to translate across into increasing the risk of GI stasis in some of these species, which again is often cited as a reason for why you shouldn't be giving these. But obviously pain in its own self is a driver for that. And if you feel you need pure mu opioids, and I'd argue that that's important. Most of the opioids undergo hepatic biotransformation and urinary excretion. So again, hepatic and kidney disease can be a factor here as well. And these are sort of your immediate sort of concerns around that peri-anesthetic surgical period, that sort of type of thing. But we do have other side effects of opioids that are well recognised in other species. Rebound hyperalgesia, so as they wear off, this animal becomes increasingly sensitive to pain. Allodynia is basically where the animal becomes heightened and is generating pain responses to a non-painful stimulus, which can be over the site of surgery, for example. So it can be over the top of what is genuinely a painful area. But you can get this being extended to non-painful areas of the body as well. So the animal may start showing pain responses to non-painful areas and chewing areas that are not painful, but nevertheless is showing a pain response in that area. And we can get dysphoric states. Pica is well recognised, certainly in rats, as a consequence. And obviously then we've got dependence, tolerance and addiction coming on here as well, subsequently. And these may be things that we don't think about too much in our patients, but certainly the first two or three of these are very relevant and we should be thinking about that. And if we want to try and reverse some of the side effects of these, there's a number of studies looking at using partial agonists such as buprenorphine or butorphanol to competitively antagonise the pure mu opioid. And in some of those papers out there, there's been some summative effect. Actually, butorphanol with morphine, for example, led to increased analgesia versus using morphine alone, for example. And maybe your butorphanol is antagonising some of the more undesirable side effects of the morphine, for example, alongside that. But the jury's a bit out on this, and some papers are showing that there is less analgesia. But certainly where you're dealing with patients where you're thinking you might be having some side effects coming through, reaching for butorphanol might be a good choice to just see if it is relevant to your patient you're dealing with. But I think we can all sit back and think, okay, we are aware of all these problems with opioids, and anything that I can do to reduce or limit the side effects of opioids in these species is very important. And obviously, if we're going to be using other agents alongside opioids, that's going to reduce the ultimate dose that I want to. But it's also going to maybe reduce the number of repeat dosing that I need to. So instead of needing 5 mg per kg of methadone every 4 hours, and I'm going to give it 4 doses, maybe I need to give it 2 mg per kg and only give 3 doses now. Maybe I can step in and start considering using buprenorphine a little bit earlier because I've used a whole variety of other agents and obviously all the other things we've discussed to try and limit the opioid usage. So to some extent, there is a logic in saying what I should be doing is using everything else first than opioids when I have to. And certainly in some countries where opioid usage in veterinary species is banned, it's prohibited, then they clearly are relying on everything else because they don't have the option of reaching for opioids. And much as it's easy to suddenly grab some methadone, which maybe we are doing, maybe we should look at saying, okay, what else can we do to limit the use of pure mu opioids in the species we're dealing with? This, of course, then brings us on to local anaesthesia. And local anaesthetics, I think, really are underused. We should be increasing our use of these, really. These block nerve impulses by binding the sodium channels. And this basically stops the transmission of the action potential in the nerve. And hey presto, we are completely stopping nerve information going to spine and brain. So your local anaesthetics is the only analgesic that actually physically blocks nerve conduction and pain transmission. All of the other analgesics we are considering are actually modifying or modulating your pain response, but local is the one thing that completely blocks it. So we've got to think about preoperative and intraoperative administration of local anaesthetics to our patients. We use lidocaine, which can have quite a short duration of action. Bupivacaine has obviously a longer duration of action as well, and that can be quite nice to do that. Lidocaine is quicker acting. Bupivacaine takes a bit longer to get up to levels as well. So the two in combination work quite nice. Again, we do worry about overdose of these, and that's something we do have to be concerned about, is getting overdoses, particularly in some of the very small patients that we're dealing with. The products that you have are as concentrated as they are, and so you know, you can get to some very, very small volumes that you want to use that maybe aren't going to have an effective blockade that you would like to have for your patient. So maximum doses really we're looking at is around 3 mg per kg lidocaine, bupivacaine around 2. We're realistically trying to use more like 1 mg per kg of both in our patients in combination in a syringe. Adrenaline can extend the local action by causing some vasoconstriction. And certainly lidocaine can be diluted down further, down to 0.2% solutions, and in, certainly in human medicine this has been used and has been shown to be as effective as the more concentrated solutions, but it's giving you a much larger volume that you can utilise to cause a blockade. And I've always been a little bit cautious of over-dilution for fear of not getting adequate blockade, but down to this sort of values in the human field it is sort of used, and therefore it is obviously appropriate. And I'm just putting Emla here to an aside, really. Don't forget lidocaine, prilocaine in your Emla cream. It is quite useful. We use this for obviously doing blood samples, placing catheters, but obviously post-operatively on surgical wounds, for example, for limiting self-trauma, particularly in the rats, can be quite useful. And I wouldn't underestimate this as a local blockade, admittedly only skin deep, but nevertheless it's still going to be a benefit. And then it's a question of how you're going to apply your local anaesthetic to these patients. So if we're going to be placing an intraosseous needle, for example, for fluid therapy, or if we're going to be placing, say, a surgical site, so we have a castration here where we can infiltrate the vas and the skin with a local blockade, it's going to be effective, like I say, quite some time afterwards. These are sort of applications that we need to be considering. We're not really going into nerve blocks and epidurals today, but again, obviously, you know, there's lots of other applications for your local anaesthetics, and developing those techniques and practicing them in your small mammal patients wouldn't be a bad move. When we start looking at other agents which can provide analgesia, we obviously also have the alpha-2 agonists, and dexmedetomidine maybe being our singular preferred choice now out of the alpha-2s for these patients. And these basically provide analgesia at the level of the spinal cord. We do have to account for the fact that, of course, if you're going to reverse these with atipamazole, then any analgesic effect will be reversed as well. Again, it's competitive antagonism here, so and generally your atipamazole might last for a shorter duration if you're going to be using other alpha-2 agents instead. So, you know, if we're having a short duration here, dexmedetomidine may be giving you 20-30 minutes of sedation. So maybe you don't need to be reversing this. And the analgesia for the dexmedetomidine is often reported to extend beyond the sedative effects. Whereas in traditional medetomidine, it may be that your analgesia is wearing out at a similar time as your sedation. So if your animal's recovering fine and you're happy with that, then don't reverse your dexmedetomidine. You may be getting some additional analgesia without necessarily compromising or extending the recovery of that patient. When we come on to ketamine, again, this is an NMDA antagonist, and this, I guess, really is preventing the spinal sensation to pain. So it's preventing what we call spinal wind-up. So it's not necessarily blocking pain per se, it's preventing this heightened response to pain at the spinal cord level. So if you give it alone or you give it at the analgesic doses, then you get minimal sedation as well. And interestingly enough, the analgesic effects of ketamine can outlast the blood serum level. So there's other effects here that can mean it's got a far longer lasting duration than you would perhaps anticipate. A single dose, even at very low dose of 0.2 mg per kg, can give analgesia for up to 2 or 3 hours in people. And again, it can reverse some of the opioid effects that we can see, so neuropathic pain, the anhedonia, the hyperalgesia. Maybe this is something very beneficial to have alongside opioid therapy. And it also can act to reduce chronic pain post-procedure as well. Again, I guess by mediating some of these side effects from pure muse. I put paracetamol here just because obviously there's quite a number of studies looking at paracetamol safety in rodents and things from a human point of view. It gives very mild analgesia. We're concerned about liver toxicity. Dosage rates reported are very variable. And I would basically say I wouldn't use it. But you might have some owners that are running out giving their animals cow pollen. It's worthwhile to know what sort of dosage range you can do. But realistically, I don't think this is going to be of any real benefit to our patients per se. Then if we look at gabapentin is the next on our list. We do actually use maybe increasing amounts of gabapentin here, more in the management of neurological pain, where we're thinking we may have spinal issues contributing to discomfort. There are side effects that you can get with gabapentin, and you may get anorexia, some neurological signs as well with that, and it maybe can be quite difficult and to quantify, particularly if you're using this for neurological pain or discomfort in a rabbit with econiculi, for example, or lumbar sacral discomfort. And this obviously is relevant to CNS inhibition as well, so just bear in mind that those are possible, and we tend to be going with quite a low dose initially, orally, to see if this is having a beneficial effect in our patients, but we are taking that steady and monitoring for side effects. Nitrous oxide is also on our list, which is something, again, we very rarely use. Minimal cardiovascular and respiratory depression, but it has quite a low potency in a lot of these species, and if you're looking at using this alongside an inhalant, you may be going to be lowering your inhalant reliance by sort of 0.25%, so a very small amount. And given we need to have a secure airway to be using this, and realistically we've got a lot of patients with small thoracic cavities and a large underlying respiratory disease, and we do worry about hypoxia as concerns with that, and really nitrous oxide is also falling off of our list really because of those concerns as well. So nevertheless, think about it, but like I say, in many cases we're ignoring it. We then come on to continuous rate infusions for these patients, and obviously there's a variety of agents that you can use for that. Obviously, opioids is a considered use here. Dexmedetomidine is a good one here. Ketamine is a good one here as well for the CRIs. And the advantage of CRIs in these patients really is we're trying to even out the blood serum levels. So this is going to stop us getting peaks and troughs in our pain control, and obviously if we're running a CRI through that patient, that may be reducing the levels of other agents that we need to be considering using. And if we look at ketamine, we looked at dexmedetomidine, which I think are two great, brilliant, brilliant products for using as a continuous rate infusion. You've got a little loading dose you give to these, followed by a CRI rate. And basically, the cardiovascular and respiratory effects of dexmedetomidine at this sort of level is negligible. I would argue in the rabbits where we're using this, we're maybe getting a reduction in heart rate by maybe 20, 30 beats per minute of what you'd anticipate to be normal for that patient without an alpha 2. So what we're doing with these when we're pre-medding our patients, in many cases, again, this question, what do you want pre-med with? But we're using the loading doses of the CRI at the time of induction, following that loading dose with the induction agent, whichever one you end up choosing, followed by then running this patient on a CRI. And what we actually do is we run this through our IV fluids anyway, and so we end up just having a ratio that we're using for our patient, with the fluid therapy rate being dependent on size, and the CRI rate then obviously is consistent because it's turning out into a ratio to be set up. And that works really, really nice for all our patients, really. We do, of course, add in opioids into this, generally pure mu opioids alongside that, although there are CRIs that you can use buprenorphine in, for example. Again, you've got the loading doses here, followed by bigs per kick per hour, and we'll use, you know, one of these in addition to that. Again, with the fentanyl, if you're going to do that, obviously you can top up your fentanyl for a short-acting period if you're going to have a particularly painful period during anesthesia. And I suppose it's a question of how you're setting your continuous rate infusions up. Your continuous rate infusion doesn't have to be at a constant rate, if that makes sense. It's just at a continuous rate. We're using ours as a constant rate because we're balancing that with fluid therapy. But certainly if you were to run a continuous rate infusion separate to your fluid therapy, then there's nothing to stop you from doubling or trebling the rate of that infusion during a particularly painful period during anesthesia, then lowering it down at other time periods, and obviously then lowering it down further in recovery. So there's nothing to stop you titrating, and there is quite a wide range in the human literature of the CRIs that you can use. So it's all a question of how you set things up and how it works for you in your clinical setting. The one thing that I will say to you as a point of note, and this is really is more a methadone point here, when we have been looking at running through the CRIs, the question is always, as soon as I stop the CRI, how soon after do I switch on to giving parenteral boluses of agent? If it's methadone, if you stop your CRI and then give a therapeutic dose of methadone around half a mg per kg immediately afterwards, you will profoundly sedate your patient for quite some time period, even to the point that you're getting some of the classical signs of opioid toxicosis almost appearing, or some of the acute concerns with that. So if you're going to be switching to using methadone boluses after a methadone CRI, wait 2 hours before you're going to administer that next dose. Again, I probably use a similar rule of thumb for morphine, whereas because fentanyl is so short-acting, then obviously if you want to give a top-up of your fentanyl, that can be given immediately as your CRI finishes. But bear in mind, if fentanyl is really going to be lasting for 5 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour, in most cases, if you're running a fentanyl CRI, as soon as that fentanyl CRI has finished, you are following with another pure mu opioid, whether that be methadone, whether that be morphine, whether it be buprenorphine, but basically you've got to have something else to follow on instantly after that fentanyl CRI, because in its own right, it's not going to be doing you any real favours. In summary, really, then, I suppose the mainstay of options that we are using as standard for these would be non-steroidals, alongside buprenorphine for medical cases where we're thinking pain may be significant, switching maybe onto oral tramadol or gabapentin alongside that for more management of chronic pain. If we're going through any surgical procedure, then think about your local blockade, either by doing specific nerve blocks, epidural or splash blocks, mixing bupivacaine and lidocaine. That's pretty much a standard for any surgical procedure that we're undertaking. And obviously, if you're then thinking that your level of invasiveness or pain is increasing, then at that point we're switching on to pure mu opioids. And generally, if we're switching on to pure mu opioids, then we're also implementing a CRI at that point. So these are automatically getting ketamine, dexmedetomidine with a pure mu opioid CRI at the same time as well, alongside your local blockade, alongside your non-steroidals as well, when we're dealing with that patient. We do have a couple of questions that has been asked. The first one coming up is, what if I don't have intravenous access? And obviously, that is of concern. A lot of the techniques that we will be using, very applicable to rabbits, very applicable to ferrets, maybe less so in some of the other species where intravenous access is limited. And in those intraosseous routes, you can run infusions and analgesics through the intraosseous route. That works just as well for those patients. But if you really are down to being able to only have subcutaneous, intramuscular, or intraperitoneal routes available to you, then I would be encouraging to you maximize your use of your local blockade. And if you do want to trickle in some ketamine or dexmedetomidine as part of a premedicant, that's fine. But again, don't be reversing your alpha-2 in those circumstances unless you have to. Again, think of the ketamine and alpha-2 more as giving you additional multimodal analgesia, maybe, more than being a heavy sedative. And certainly, you don't want to be giving a high dose of an alpha-2 to a rat, for example, having a mammary mass removal. But trickling a little bit in may help your situation, maybe alongside your buprenorphine and a local blockade. And certainly, rats are the species where we will be seeing quite a major issue. Second question we've been asked is using local and its effect on wound healing. I think, to be fair, the doses that we're considering using and the length of time it's being used for within the first sort of 8 hours post-surgery, we're not really seeing any evidence that this is impairing wound healing significantly. I'd argue a patient self-traumatizing a wound is more of concern to that. So we have absolutely no issues with using local as fairly routine for all of our patients post-surgery without causing a major crisis. The downside you do have, of course, is that local is painful when you're instilling it. So for most of our patients, we'll be giving the local blockade. We are anaesthetizing that patient, and the local blockade is being placed as soon as we've cleaned and scrubbed the area. We're placing that local blockade. The area is then being re-scrubbed. We're prepping for surgery, such that local blockade is ineffective by the time before we start cutting on surgery. So that is the end of the webinar. I'm now going to pass you back to Emma. Thank you all for attending.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Kevin for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.